And God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Honor your father and your mother, so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male or female servants, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Before Simon comes to preach to us,
grab a seat. As Johnny said, we're working our way through a series in the Ten Commandments. It's found in the book of Exodus in the Old Testament. Each summer at Village Kensington, we study a chunk of this book. And this year, we've arrived at these famous Ten Laws. It would be good if you could have that open, page 77, in these blue Bibles in front of you. You know, it is really important to see these Ten Commandments in their context. If you look at the beginning of chapter 20, we read, and God spoke all these words, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. We've been reminding ourselves of those words every week. The God of the universe has personally intervened in the life of Israel and rescued them from slavery in Egypt. This personal revelation is seen in the name Lord. Do you see it there in verse 2, the capital letters? Lord. God has revealed his personal name to Israel. Yahweh, I am who I am. It told them of his character and nature, his covenantal name. It signifies the relationship that he is now in with Israel. And it's in this relationship that the rules for living with this loving, saving, amazing God are given. That's the order. We've got to get it the right way round. Relationship, what God has done for us, and in response we know him and follow him and love him. We obey him. It's a little bit like my relationship with my kids, Ted and Phoebe. They were born into our family, myself and Sharon. I love them unconditionally. I would literally give my life for my kids. And in this family, Ted and Phoebe live by our loving rules. They don't get to do what they want. So, for instance, my son Ted at the moment, he's a 12-year-old autistic boy. He is obsessed by cars, obsessed by them. And he would love, at the age of 12, to drive the family car. And you'll be pleased to know, I don't give him the keys. Now, sometimes Ted literally can't get his head around that command. He can't understand it. He just doesn't get why. I say, Ted, trust me, you can't drive the car. Now, as these Ten Commandments unfold, the first few speak directly of this relationship with the Lord, his people, how they are to acknowledge him. No other gods before him, and approach him. How they are to speak to him and about him in the right way. How they are to live before him in a way that treasures and honors and delights in the one true God. And then the following commandments work out what living before God in his world should look like. honor your father and mother. Love your neighbor, involving how you treat their personhood. Don't murder, don't be angry. Their partner, husband and wife, and now property. That's actually quite a helpful way to think through these parts of the commandments, isn't it? Loving our neighbor and think of his person and his partner in marriage and now property. You shall not steal. Having saved money as a lifeguard, what a way to begin, eh? He invested it wisely, eventually building a company, Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities. He employed many of his family members. One of the standout differences of Bernie from the beginning of his business was his emphasis on integrity. On the company website, he, for all to see, was his commitment to the highest ethical standards. In the world of the stockbroker and financier, this was refreshing. Bernie Madoff's company continued to grow. He was a pioneer of electronic trading, eventually becoming the chairman of NASDAQ, the electronic stock exchange in New York. However, in 2008, at the height of the global financial crisis, it all came tumbling down. As investors began withdrawing their money, it came to light that Madoff's whole business in stockbroking had been one big lie. It is considered the largest fraud in the history of Wall Street, costing his clients, it included many famous American charities, costing his clients almost $57 billion. Now, we hear examples like that. Bernie stole a lot of money, $57 billion, and we think, hey, I haven't done that. I can put a tick next to this command. But I'm not so sure. I want to suggest to you that when we stop to think about it, just as with all of these commands, we fail far more frequently and extensively than we imagine. But let's begin by setting this command in the biblical context. That's always a good thing to do. So firstly, God gives us gifts. God gives us gifts. As we've been doing with these commandments, we need to start back in Genesis and the creation of the world. When God made the world and the first human pair, Adam and Eve, to inhabit it, he gave them work to do. In Genesis chapter 1, God tells them to fill the earth and subdue it. In the following chapter, God commands them to work it and take care of it. This is a really important foundation to lay. We'll come back to it at the end. Everything that we have belongs to God and has been given to us by God to steward on his behalf. That doesn't mean we can't enjoy and take pleasure in the possessions that we own. It does mean that our ultimate enjoyment and pleasure is in God, the giver of the gifts. That's why our delight and our enjoyment should always land in God, who he is. But we want the gifts, but not the giver. When Satan tempted our first parents in the Garden of Eden, he tempted them to steal from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, the fruit that God had forbidden them to eat. That tree symbolized God's authority to decide what is right and wrong. So not only did Adam and Eve steal the fruit, they stole the role and glory that belonged to God alone. He knows best. He rules. And in that rejection of God's love and rules, in that sin, humanity fell from the perfect bliss of knowing God and his ways. Now all of us live for self, our wants and desires. So God is pushed out of life, and life becomes all about us and this material existence. It's therefore no surprise that one of the manifestations of that is the desire to get as much as we can, to be as self-fulfilled as we can. That is what we now worship. Almost to the day, 22 years ago, George Swanson was buried in a cemetery in Pennsylvania in his car, a 1984 white Corvette. He bought 12 plots, burial plots, dug a big hole, and on the 25th of May 1994, a crane lowered him and his car into the ground. His wife, Caroline, said, "George always said he lived a fabulous life and he went out in fabulous style. A lot of people, they say they want to take it with them. He took it with them." It's said, "He who dies with the most toys wins." But I say that he who dies with the most toys dies. But with God out of the picture, life becomes about the things that we own, and we often try and get as much as we can, however we can. So staying with cars, there were in England and Wales an estimated 872,000 vehicle-related thefts in the year ending June 2015. And that was apparently an all-time low. Over the same period, there were an estimated 750,000 incidents of domestic burglary. In 2012, the annual fraud indicator put the loss to the UK economy from fraud at £73 billion. The list for the types of fraud is unbelievably extensive. I'm going to take you halfway through the alphabet. Benefit, council tax, electricity scams, grant fraud, housing tenancy, insurance, mass marketing, mortgage, motor finance, national savings, patient charges, payroll pension. That's how far we've got in the alphabet. Have we never taken what doesn't belong to us? Something from the workplace not returned? Something from our mum's purse as a kid? Something lent to us that we haven't given back? Copying music, illegal downloading of media. The Bible, in a very short sentence, it's actually only two words in the Hebrew, is really clear. No stealing. So, God gives good gifts. We want the gifts, but not the giver. Now, thirdly, the command to use God's gifts rightly. With this eighth command, the Bible gives dignity to personal possessions. Just as we saw from the opening chapters of Genesis, we are made in God's image, made to work in this world, made to enjoy the fruit of our work. The Bible understands that in human society, property and possessions will be owned, and that that is crucial for the stability and the flourishing of society. It allows for the raising of the children, for the well-being of society as a whole. But just as we were considering, the Bible is clear that the gaining of possessions and the use of them is to have integrity and honesty and compassion before God. So just a couple of chapters later from this one in Exodus chapter 20, we are given an extensive unpacking of this command, "You shall not steal." Look at how chapter 22 begins. You can flip over the page or see it on the screen behind me. "Whoever steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it must pay back 5 head of cattle for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. If a thief is caught breaking in at night and is struck a fateful blow, the defender is not guilty of bloodshed. But if it happens after sunrise, the defender is guilty of bloodshed. Anyone who steals must certainly make restitution." The chapter goes on to speak about cattle that accidentally graze in a neighbor's field. Fire that starts in your property but that spreads to other properties. What happens when a possession that you've borrowed gets stolen, or cattle that you've borrowed dies? The Bible clearly honors the concept of property and possessions and has clear instructions for the circumstances where those possessions are unfairly lost or damaged. But it also gives great detail about how we treat each other economically. So, for example, in this same passage near the end, instructions are given for the integrity and fairness of giving a loan. Look at verse 25. "If you lend money to one of my people," so an Israelite to an Israelite, "among you who is needy, do not treat it as a business deal. Charge no interest." Here we see concern for the poor debtor rather than the wealthy lender. God is never satisfied with a "it's not personal, just business" approach. It is clearly viewed as robbing the poor to make profit from someone else's difficult circumstances. The book of Amos, chapter 8, speaks directly about this kind of exploitation. "Hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor of the land, saying, 'When will the new moon be over, that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath be ended, that we may market wheat?' Skimping on the measure, boosting the price, cheating with dishonest scales." Here it's not interest rates that are the problem, as blatant overpricing and using dishonest means to gain maximum profit. The book of Proverbs speaks about a false balance being an abomination to the Lord. I think we need to examine ourselves, and we haven't got time to do this in detail, about ways that we may well be complicit with this kind of corporate thievery. An example would be the place where our gadgets are assembled, or our clothes are made. What kinds of wages are our laborers being paid? What kind of profit margins are companies making? All of this addresses the eighth command, "You shall not steal." As one writer puts it, it speaks of the integrity, honesty, and compassion, compassionate care for justice and fairness in all the ways that we make use of the material things that God has given us in this world to enjoy. Now, as I said earlier, I want to suggest to you that when we hear the command, "Do not steal," even when we think about all those examples, Bernie Madoff, and even the bank robber and house burglar, we can think, well, I've never done that. I've never been involved in that. But as we've been seeing over the past few weeks, that is a superficial understanding of what God is saying. It's been Jesus who has taken us to the heart of the matter. When we hear "do not murder," Jesus says, if you're angry with someone, you're in danger of judgment. Or when we hear "do not commit adultery," Jesus says, if you look at a woman lustfully, you've already committed adultery in your heart. So when we think of this command against stealing, we will do well to think through the many ways that it is possible to break this command. Here are some examples. I'd want to suggest that one of the most frequently common ways we could do that is through the theft of time. So employees are contracted to do so many hours of work for an agreed salary. The question is, how often do we fail to do that? We arrive late, finish early, we take longer coffee or lunch breaks than we're allowed, we waste an idle time away. This command is also broken when we fail to pay back debts that we owe. We know that money that we borrowed is owed, and yet we purposely allow those debts to continue with no real intention or plan to pay them back. The New Testament is really clear. Owe no one anything except to love each other. If we love our neighbor, we should have purposeful intentions and plans in paying back the loan, the student loan, the mortgage, as we're able. It's also possible to steal a reputation. Think about that. To steal someone's reputation through malicious gossip. "Whoever steals my purse steals trash," says Shakespeare. "But he that filches from me my good name makes me poor indeed." We are robbing a person of their standing and respectful and respect when in other relationships we talk about people in a gossipy, slanderous way. And is it not possible to steal from God? Perhaps to our shame, that is the easiest aspect of this eighth command to overlook. All praise belongs to God. All of our time and abilities, all the possessions and money we have come from God and belong to Him. The prophets in the Old Testament asked the question, "Will you rob God?" And the answer is, of course we do. And in fact, the way that we conduct our relationships with others, our parents, our husbands and wives, the material goods, all this reflects our relationship with God. Is He receiving the honor and glory that belongs to Him from our actions? Or are we robbing Him? And I hope that as we meditate on this command, we realize that none of us have kept it. All of us have failed to use our possessions in a way that honors God. All of us have stolen from others, whether it's taking things that do not belong to us, not returning what we owe, how we work, how we deal with others, what we owe God. Now, how much should we rejoice that this is not the end of the biblical story, and that God, rather than grasping, gives, continues to give with unbelievable generosity. We've already thought of the many gifts that he's given, but what of God's greatest gift? God's greatest gift is, of course, his Son, Jesus Christ. And this gift is the ultimate expression of God's grace. Grace means lovingly being given what we don't deserve. We steal for self, which brings judgment. God gives us his Son, which offers salvation. All that God has done for us in Jesus is an expression of his rich generosity. Do you remember what we saw in the book of Hebrews last term? Jesus did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, though it belonged to him. The glory of God rightfully belonged to him, but he willingly gave it up for the likes of you and me. How very different from how we act. We steal. Jesus gives. Do you remember when the soldiers came to arrest Jesus? In Matthew chapter 26, Jesus asked them, "Why do you come out against me with swords and clubs as if I were," and the word that Matthew uses is thief. Our NIV translation hides that sadly. Jesus was no breaker of this eighth commandment. He was perfect. But in the following chapter of Matthew's gospel, we witness Jesus being crucified between two thieves. Matthew again uses the same word. Jesus is being treated as if he broke the eighth commandment. He's identifying with lawbreakers like us and taking the place and punishment it deserves. That's how the price is paid for the failure to live as God commands us to. Jesus willingly gives his life, paying the penalty that thieves like us deserve so that we might be forgiven. So, track this with me. God gives us good gifts. We want the gifts, but not the giver. So the command to use God's gifts rightly, we clearly break over and over again. And the response? God gives us his greatest gift. And that means, finally, we have a choice. There are only two ways to live in light of this command. We can steal for self, or we can be stewards for God. We thought a lot about stealing for self, about wanting the gifts and not the giver, what that looks like in life. We can choose, you know, to live like that. You can. And you know, when we push God out of the picture and this world becomes all that there is, that kind of attitude is a natural conclusion. Our attitude to others will ultimately be about how they can serve me, what they can do for me, and we'll do whatever it takes to coerce, manipulate, emotionally blackmail to get what I want. And we can do that with stuff, accruing stuff, getting stuff to make us as comfortable, pleasurable as we can in this life. The problem with that is the very things that we try and possess actually end up possessing us. They rule us. They consume us. As we become enamored with stuff and possessions, they get a grip of our hearts so that when we look at our lives and our week and the things that we do and the things that we daydream about and the things on our internet search, we realize we are consumed with possessions. They rule us. Jesus warned about that. He said, "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions." Jesus taught that this kind of attitude, where we store up things for ourselves, forget God, will send us to eternal destruction. He did, he said that. So what does being a steward for God look like? By steward, I mean someone who manages all they have as ultimately belonging to God, on behalf of God. Well, in the first place, it means confessing to God that by nature, we steal for self and need forgiveness. It means coming to Jesus and saying that, Jesus, I'm sorry. Simon, I'm a stealer. My heart is enamored with that kind of possessions. I want to get all I can. I'm sorry. And it means trusting that in his life and death, Jesus is able and mighty to save. That Jesus has done what is needed to provide forgiveness for that kind of heart that I have. The greatest example of this in the New Testament, I wonder if I could say, think of a New Testament character. Now, who comes to mind where we see this kind of attitude? It's Luke's account, isn't it? A man called Zacchaeus. There we read of a chief tax collector. He was unsurprisingly a wealthy man. The way tax collectors made money was by charging the Roman tax and then adding a little bit of commission on the top for themselves. Zacchaeus had worked his way to the top of that kind of life and had gotten very rich along the way. And then one day, what happens to Zacchaeus? He meets Jesus. And Jesus reaches out to him and invites Zacchaeus into his home, and that proves to be a life-transforming encounter. Zacchaeus, after meeting Jesus, famously says these words, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I have cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus says to him, "Today salvation has come to this house." You see, Zacchaeus has encountered God's greatest gift, and it has totally transformed his life from the inside out. That is what we all need. We need heart transformations, where because of Jesus, God writes his law on our hearts. That's what happens when we trust and follow Jesus. When we do that, Jesus comes and lives in us by the Holy Spirit, and our desires are turned upside down. And it's no longer how much we can keep, but how much we can give away. Now, that is a lifetime process. I want to encourage you, follower of the Lord Jesus. You hear this, see, that is me. I steal. And I'm trusting in Jesus, but I'm not changed like that. We need to pray for Holy Spirit power to be changed, and to keep each other accountable, and to speak and encourage one another. The Apostle Paul can write to the church in Ephesus. He says this, "Anyone who has been stealing must steal no longer." And look what he says. He must work, doing something useful with his hands, gain possessions, work hard, enjoy the fruit of it. But look at why. That they may have something to share with those in need. You see how the stealer has been turned into a steward. Once life was all about him or her getting what they can. Now it's about God-honoring work with the purpose of sharing with others. You know, as I finish, a lovely demonstration of this is found in Paul's letter to the church in Corinth, 1 Corinthians. Corinth is, of course, in southern Greece. And as he encourages them to be exactly this, generous stewards of God's stuff, he talks about brothers and sisters that are in churches in the north of Corinth, in a place called Macedonia. And look at what he says. He says to them, look, these Macedonian churches, in the midst of a very severe trial, their overflowing joy and their extreme poverty welled up in rich generosity. For I testify that they gave as much as they were able and even beyond their ability, entirely on their own, they urgently pleaded with us for the privilege of sharing in this service to the Lord's people. You see how Christ-like these Christian brothers and sisters are? Knowing Jesus has utterly transformed their attitude to property and wealth. All that they had was to be used for God's glory, stewarding his world well, using his gifts carefully. What a contrast. What a transformation from our natural stealing selves. What a glorious vision of a new humanity where peace and justice reign. So as we finish, let us not forget that this takes place, this transformation, stealing for self, suddenly steward for God, that takes place only through the loving, trusting, following work of Jesus Christ, trusting him. We've seen that though God gives us good gifts, we want the gifts but not the giver. And so the command to use God's gifts rightly, do not steal, hey, we break it in all kinds of ways. But God in his grace gives his greatest gift, Jesus gives, who dies for sinful men and women like me and you, dies as a thief on a cross so that we might go free. Let us live today in the light of all that Jesus has done, a transformed life of faithful stewardship and sacrificial giving.